So thank you all for coming tonight. I think most of you know the inviting of the bell to start and end meditation. In a certain way, it serves to begin and end. You know, it's like a timer. But much more importantly, it is a aid to help quiet and concentrate the mind. So when the bell is invited, when we listen, we try just to be empty of any thoughts, empty of any conceptions, and just let the sound wash through us. Just listen deeply. And then you listen because you know the sound just gets fainter and fainter and fainter and fainter. And then it's invited again, same thing happens, and then a third time. And usually if you've been able to just relax and just listen, by the time the third bell ends, and you just, gradually it fades away, and then you get into the silence, it sort of brings you into a state of awareness and concentration. So the bell is not just a timekeeper, a start and ender, but it's really something that brings us. Actually, there's a little bell gotter poem that goes, "Listen, listen, this wonderful sound brings me back to my true home." Now, again, most of us think of our home as a physical place, right? But in this tradition, to be in the present, to be right here, and to be comfortable, at ease, open, safe. This is the best home, because the physical home always can change. And again, it's just a structure. But when you develop the capacity to find a true home, a true place of rest, a true place of safety, a true place of comfort, on your own, just by letting go of everything and just being present, right? That's a great gift that you give to yourself. So the bell helps us learn how to do it. So before we return to Zen Chan Master Han Shan, are there any questions anybody has about practice? The practice of meditation, the practices we did tonight, or more importantly, as importantly, just how you bring the practice into your daily life. Anybody has any questions or things that aren't clear?
Mm-hmm. How fast should you meditate? How slow should you meditate? How much fresh air should you absorb? How much activity should you obtain? How many bowings and stuff like that? You know, from Buddha's arm and the sangha prayers.
Yeah. Well,
how concrete must your morning be before your day just relaxes? Mm-hmm. You know, how should you be mindful when you're mindful
right.
Waking up? How do you find this on the internet?
Well, yeah, again, Noah, I think starting off your day with so much work, meditative work, it might be hard then to get into a relaxed day. I would say you know, your morning meditation, you want to set the tone for your day. Right? So what is the tone of your day? Do you want it to be? Do you want it to be you know, do you want to live in mindfulness? Do you want to live in awareness? Do you want to live in compassion, loving kindness, patience? Right? So your morning practice should be something that nourishes those seeds in you. Right? You don't want to make, you know, a lot of people's practice, it's like it becomes like a to-do list. You know what I mean? Well, in my meditation, I got to do this and this and this and this. You know, so what, right? We make our spiritual life just like our ordinary life, where we're just kind of doing things and, you know, accumulating, you know, knocking off things on our list. It's important that the practice be meaningful, you know, and that we don't just go through it like a bunch of activity that we need to go through. You know, there's a saying in Zen that says, one moment of pure awareness, 1 inch a Buddha.
One inch
a Buddha. So just, you know, we may not be fully enlightened Buddhas, but if we have the capacity of touching places of just mindfulness and awareness in that moment, right, we are a one-inch Buddha. And that's really how you want to start your day. And again, I think it's also good to, because we have very few reminders that remind us to be mindful, to remind us to practice during the day in most of our lives. I think it's worthwhile to, if we, in our morning meditation, to kind of, what can I say, kind of toward the end, to kind of think about your day, you know, in terms of what activities you'll be doing, and really set the path already in your mind of how you want to do it, right? So already we're planting seeds of how we want the day to unfold. Because unfortunately for many of us, we get up from our meditation cushion and it's sort of like the practice is forgotten, you know, until we come home at night and, you know, where did that day go? So that's a challenge. And I think one of the ways to kind of make it easier is to, in the morning, just kind of spend a few moments just thinking about your day, you know, very practically, concretely, and really kind of just imagine, kind of use your creative imagination to kind of see yourself going through your days with greater mindfulness. You know what I mean? You may kind of just imagine yourself walking down the hall to where you work, and just seeing that you're doing it as if you're doing walking meditation. Or you may imagine that if you're on the phone during the day, that you're picking up the phone on the fourth ring, and the first three rings you're just breathing. Things like that, you know. So you kind of imagine that you're building in these moments of mindfulness and awareness during the day. There may be a particular challenge, you know, with a person that causes you in the past to feel irritated or anxious or impatient or judgmental, you know what I mean? And if we step back and we kind of reflect on our life, we see these things very clearly. And so we may want to prepare our minds how we want to handle this differently, respond differently. So when these situations then occur, it's not as if we're blindsided, but we're really kind of, you know, preparing the pathways in our mind already to deal with these situations more consciously, which consciously means, and this is really, I think, what a lot of, you know, spiritual practice is really about. Most of us do not live our life consciously. You know what I mean? We don't live a life of intention. Most of us live our life just the way we've been conditioned. So we're always just responding and reacting to things the way we always have. And often, you know, that way we do it is often not way we've chosen, but way we've been conditioned to deal with things. And so if we really want to transform and change to become, let's say, the person that we know we have the capacity to be, that often means we have to be a lot more conscious about how we're, you know, the way we're perceiving situations, the way we're speaking, and, you know, kind of what we're doing, you know, could be what we're eating or, you know, all things like that. But to get from the place of living in total reactivity, total conditioning, to get to the point where we're really free, right, to really live the way we want, right, it just doesn't go from here to here. It takes time and practice and its steps. And the more that we learn how to set forth that kind of intentionality, and then to, you know, continue with it during the day, and then get the benefits of that, you know, sometimes we do better than others, sometimes we succeed, sometimes we don't, but we're changing the pathways. And the change and transformation will come quicker that way if we bring a lot more consciousness and intentionality to our life. You know, a spiritual path, you know, Buddhist path, spiritual path, we say over and over, is about freedom. Right? We hear these words around, you know, freedom, liberation. But what does that mean? It means that we are free of our conditioning. Just because we have been conditioned a certain way, to think a certain way, to act a certain way, by our society, by our families, etc. If we realize that those ways do not produce well-being, happiness, you know, all those kinds of things, we have the capacity to change them. How do we change them? By liberating ourselves from our conditioning. It takes a lot of consciousness. It doesn't take a lot of struggle, doesn't take a lot of battle. It just takes a lot of awareness and a desire to be free. So let's see what Han Shan said. So for those you've been with us, as most you've had over these weeks, we're dealing with the something called the Maxims of Han Shan. Han Shan was a Chinese Chan master, Zen master. Again, Chan is the Chinese for what became known as Zen when it got to Japan. And his dates were 1546 to 1623. So he lived, you know, almost 400 years ago, and lived a life very differently than ours. But I think you'll find his wisdom very relevant. But before I return to his teachings, I wanted to read a little bit, just a little anecdote from his biography, his autobiography, just give you a sense of the kind of guy he was. So this was his 30th year. He was 30 years old. It was the year 1575 to 1576. And he writes, "On the fifth day of the second month, we encamped at Ta Yuan Temple. And by the third day of the third month, we were able to reach North Peak's Dragon Gate Temple." Now, this is, again, very instructive. You know, we find that in the ancient days, the old days, we find the masters lived a very interesting and very free lives. I mean, they might be in a temple monastic situation for several years, very involved with, you know, organizational stuff and, you know, restoring monasteries and printing things and doing rituals and, you know, and then all of a sudden they just take off. They go up in the mountains, they go on pilgrimage, they go wandering, you know, for years, you know. Just 2-3 years, and they, you know, go set up a hut somewhere in some mountain for a year or two, and you know, just meditate. Very interesting, the way they live their lives. Not very conventional. So in his 30 years, he's up there. He's up on North Peak Dragon Gate Temple, and the abbot had permitted us to occupy an old hut that was situated high among the snowdrifts. And there, surrounded by beautiful snow-white scenery, I experienced a heavenly bliss, and my body and mind were filled with delight as I entered a paradise of bliss. Sounds pretty good. And we don't know if this is really from deep meditative practice or just the beauty of just being in this mountain fastness and seeing the mountains and the snow and the peace, you know. But he said, His mind was filled with delight. He was happy. Now, he says, a few days later, when Miao Feng, and that was his kind of meditation buddy that he had been traveling with and meditating together, he left to visit someplace. I was able to sit alone in deep and silent meditation. I was soon so absorbed in meditation that if someone had roused me and showed me a Chinese character, I wouldn't have recognized it. So he's talking about a deep kind of meditative trance state, right? Where he was so absorbed in his meditative experience that even though he was Chinese, but his kind of thinking conceptual mind wasn't even operating. Right? So he's saying, even if somebody, it's like if somebody showed us, we were an English word that we always knew the meaning, it wouldn't register. He just was in a very powerful, non-conceptual state. Now, this is what I wanted to share with you. So he said, when we first arrived at the hut, the noise of the roaring wind and the running water used to disturb me. Since it didn't seem to bother Miao Feng, that was his buddy, I asked him for an explanation. He said, and this is the key, he said, the disturbance you feel is created within your own mind. You have grasped the sound and interpreted it as noise. You should listen without judgment, concentrating on the act of merely hearing so that no thought of any kind can arise in your mind. The ancients said that whoever hears without grasping, that whoever can listen to sounds without thinking, will soon attain the Bodhisattva Vajrasattva's all-pervading wisdom. So this is, I think, a very powerful teaching for us in the 21st century. Right? So there he is, right? Deep in the mountains, all alone, you know, far away from human beings and activity, right? And what's going on? There's a waterfall nearby. And if you know on mountaintops, there's a lot of wind blowing. And it's disturbing his meditation, right? Now, we all know that, don't we? There are many of us here who, you know, when we meditate, we get everything right, right? We want everybody in the house and for blocks away to be absolutely silent, right? We want to get the New Age music playing softly and the incense going, right? We don't want to have, you know what I mean? We want it perfect, right? We don't want anything or anybody to disturb our meditation. But it even goes beyond that, right? We blame everybody for everything, don't we? Right? We say, you're making me angry, right? You're making me sad. You're the cause of my anxiety. So we, you're the cause of my stress. Right? Why am I upset? Because of you. Right? So even though this is he's experiencing something in the deep mountain fastness of China, his response is very human, isn't it? It's kind of interesting. That's why I think this is very instructive. You know, here he is, and he's going, damn waterfall, if it would only just stop making so much noise, I could have good meditation. So you see the mind has the capacity, no matter where it is, to get itself all worked up, right? So there he is all worked up, thinking his meditation is being ruined by the waterfall, and he looks over to his buddy over here, and he seems very calm and relaxed, and is, having a very good meditation, and he realized this guy knows something that I don't know, right? And so he asks him, why is it that it doesn't, he says, how come it doesn't bother you? And his brother monk says, the disturbance you feel is created within your own mind. I mean, this, if we can just get this tonight, we are on the path of transformation. Where do emotions arise? Where does the agitation arise? Where does the stress arise? In our own minds. Right? I mean, when we have a moment of clarity and rationality, we know that, don't we? Right? All our mind states, all our emotional states are arising where? Here. Right? I mean, for Fred, they're rising here. each of us would point to ourselves. When we get that, that changes things dramatically. One, that whole way we go about life thinking the problem's out there, I would be a different person if it wasn't for you. Right? I would have different emotional states if people weren't hassling me all the time. Right? I wouldn't be irritated on the road if people would just drive right. Right? It's all their fault. That's why I'm all agitated. So once we understand that all that agitation is arising in within me, and that nobody or nothing can cause that, because there is no way that somebody can get inside. I mean, when we think about it, it is ridiculous, isn't it? So if I said, Jim, you made me really angry. Just physically, how did Jim do that? Right? I mean, how did he kind of climb inside my mind, find my anger switch, and turn it on? Right? And if it worked that way, then I could say, Jim, you got me angry. But Jim didn't do that, did he? Jim just did something. Right? Over there in Jim's world, he just did something, or said something, or didn't do something, right? The reaction, whether it's the way I think about it, or the emotion, the feeling, whatever, is all occurring within my mind and body. Is there anybody who disagrees with me? So we do get it, don't we? It would really sort of be delusional, if we have any mental health people here, psychiatrists or anything, we know, people who think somebody outside of me is controlling my mind, right? We say that's a kind of psychosis, isn't it? Right? I mean, right? We say that there's something, right? And yet, we ordinary, non-psychotic people talk that way all the time, don't we? As if somebody else is controlling my mind and making me do things, right? If somebody says, some alien from Mars is controlling me and making me angry, we'd say, oh, that person is crazy, right? Psychotic. But if I said, oh, that Jim, he got me so angry the other day, we'd say, oh, yeah, I can understand. What's the difference? Just in degree. So this is the first thing he says, the disturbance you feel is created within your own mind. So that's the big one. Oh, if I'm looking for the source of my anger, my irritation, my stress, my rage, my fear, I look here. I don't look out here. Can you see how easy it is now? Right? Because if I think that, like, let's say there are 25 or 30 people here, if I think each of you has the capability of making me angry, right, I'm lost, right? I mean, and just this, it's like 30 to 1, right? So, right, I'm outnumbered. And I have to really work very hard either to what? Either to control all of you, right? So you don't get me angry, or else I got to put up a really, really strong protective shield here, right, to keep you from getting inside me. But if I understand the source of my anger is here, I don't have to be watching everyone, do I? I don't have to try to be controlling everyone, do I? Right? I only need to be watching who? If I don't want to be angry all the time, or stressed all the time, or anxious all the time, or in despair all the time, or impatient, or a lot of the time, or variations of all of this, right?
The
Well, just hold it. Just hold it, okay? Let me just share a little more of Han Shan so we continue, and then we'll come back. All right. What did you want to say?
Well, I'm just wondering from a concrete, everyday standpoint. You know, I understand the concept. You know, it comes from within. But I guess the next question I have is what's the wise thing to do? For example, say you have a colleague.
Wait, hold on. That's why I want you to hold it. Hold it. Let's just get the fundamentals.
Sure.
Okay. And then we'll talk about real life situations, but we need to get the protocol down, okay? And then we'll apply it. So the disturbance. So his meditation buddy says the disturbance you feel is created within your own mind. Now this is important because he now is telling how we go about that. You have grasped the sound and interpreted it as a noise. All right, so this is the psychological process how we get disturbed, or how we do anything else, but in this case, how with the waterfall, right? So there is a sound, right? But the mind then grasps it, right? Grasp it means what? It takes hold of it, right? The sound is just the sound, isn't it? But the mind grasps it, right? Holds on to it, and then labels it in a certain way, right? And the label, the grasping, and then the labeling has a lot to do with with the disturbance. This is the process, right? So coming back to poor Jim, I don't know. Jim does what? Let's say Jim is sitting, I'm sitting next to Jim, and he keeps moving or something, okay, during meditation. I go, right? That jerk. Right? You know what I mean? Or what kind of, wimpo meditator can sit there without moving? But can you see, I've grasped it and I've labeled it in a negative way, right? Which just then brings up lots of other kinds of agitated mental formations within my mind. So what he says here is what Han Shan has done, there is just the sound of the waterfall, right? He grasps at it and labels it what? Noise. And noise, you know, once you call, you know, the sound of the waterfall noise is something what? We don't like, right? It doesn't sound good. It's disturbing, noise. So in a very concrete way, this is what we're doing all the time. Things are unfolding. People are doing what they're doing, right? And we grasp at them and we label them. And once we label them, right, then the story goes, right? And we don't realize that it's the grasping and the labeling that has started the whole process. You have grasped the sound and interpreted it as noise. Then he says, you should listen without judgment, concentrating on the act of merely hearing so that no thoughts of any kind can arise in your mind. So now here's the instruction. Right? And it's instruction we've heard before. Can we, which means all of us, can we go through our day? Are things arising throughout the day? Constantly. As we go through our day, externally, we might say, we're constantly seeing things, we're constantly hearing things, we're constantly smelling, tasting, touching, feeling things, right? Nonstop, from the morning time we get up to the time we go to bed, right? As well as our thoughts arising constantly in our mind, feelings, perceptions, memories, right? Constantly, right? they're constantly arising. So we can say that throughout the day, things are constantly arising. Can we just allow things to... Can we just allow things to be, or are we going to grasp and label and make a story about? Somebody might do something and we go, well, that was very rude of them, wasn't it? Now, that labeling of rudeness is coming from where? From me. Right? Dan didn't like do something with a sign that said, I just want to let you know I'm being rude. Right? No, Dan just did something. Dan was Dan, I don't know. And all of a sudden I label it what? Rude. And then because I label it rude, I get what? You know, a little bit of irritation. But also, it feels good, doesn't it? Because if Dan's rude, then I'm what? I'm the opposite of rude. I'm really just what? I'm just the most considerate guy in the world, right? So there's a kind of ego self-righteousness that when we're critical of other people, label, you know, it builds us up, you know, because we're looking very good, right? And you might notice as we go through our day, we're constantly judging, evaluating, criticizing the world around us as if we are the most highly developed, purest human beings that, you know, have ever existed. Right? It's kind of bizarre. And yet we have the capacity of seeing the faults of everyone. And yet we don't realize these are just our own projections. Is the waterfall noise? The waterfall just the waterfall. The waterfall is just the waterfall. It's making the waterfall sound. And if we can just listen without grasping, without pushing it away, without labeling it, without avoiding, without... And the word grasping is a very interesting word because I think what you will find if you are present to yourself, you will find that when you are in a state of harmony, when you are in a state of openness and acceptance and equanimity and peace with life and yourself, you will feel comfortable and relaxed, right? But I would say that as we grasp at something, a thought, a story, a feeling, a situation, and, you know, emotionality gets aroused, I think you will find that you can feel yourself constricting. Right? It's often a physical kind of feeling. You feel tighter. Right? I mean, think about, you know, being very happy, warm, open, loving to someone. You know, how does that feel physically? And think about really hating somebody. Being totally disgusted by somebody, can't stand them, right? And having all kinds of stuff going on about all the terrible things they've done. Usually, we're you know, the mind and body are constricted, tight, very narrow. So it is the idea of grasping, and is really one where the mind and body constrict, and the heart constricts. You should listen without judgment, concentrating on the act of merely hearing so that no thoughts of any kind arise in your mind. The ancients said that whoever hears without grasping, that is, whoever can listen to sounds without thinking, will soon attain the Bodhisattva Vajrasattva's all-pervading wisdom. The Bodhisattva Vajrasattva was a Vajrasattva is a Sanskrit word, means the one who hears the cries of the world. And it is said that the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara actually came to enlightenment meditating by a river and just listening to the sound. And when one listens deeply, so that self and other disappear. You know, usually we begin in the world of duality. There's me listening to the sounds. You see, there are three things going on. There's a self, me, there's an object, the sound, and then there's the act of listening, right? As if three different things. But when one lets go and enters deeply the sound, one becomes the sound. And that world of duality, that world of self and other, that world of separation disappears. We know, we all have those kinds of experiences, don't we? Maybe listening to music or playing music or, mothers and fathers talk about that oneness with their child, right? There's no sense of separation, right? We know athletes and runners talk about getting into the zone or feeling that sense where all of a sudden everything is effortless, right? There's no more striving. There's no more me trying to do anything. It just... So it's that kind of state, and this is the kind of involvement in life that we are seeking. When there's no separation, and we can do that with people we work with, we can do that with our work, we can do that with our family members, we can do it at all times. When we just have the capacity of just being totally present and open to whatever we're doing. So the sound is just one example. It's quite beautiful. But let's just talk about it a few minutes. So you had a question. So some people are doing what?
Some people can just do something.
Like, what are they doing, these people?
They are, they swallow loudly.
They what?
Swallow loudly in the meditation hall. I mean,
if somebody swallows loudly in the meditation hall, okay.
Right, so, that's something that they're doing, it has nothing to do with you, and you can choose to react or not react. Then some people, hypothetically, can be, for example, very condescending.
Condescending, for example, meaning what?
Talking down or talking down in a you're inferior, I'm superior, right?
Mm-hmm.
And something more, something more personal about that, I guess, versus just someone swallowing that. I mean,
sure.
Oh, it's not like a swallowing that to bother that person in the room, right? My question is, and I always get stuck with, I can take this moment to observe, to watch how I react, and then there's a certain point that you're having to interact with the person a lot, where you're not at that point yet where you can just kind of sit back and just let it pass.
Yeah.
In a sort of non-violent communication way.
or a violent communication way. Right? There are choices here.
So the whole when you do, I feel.
Yeah, yeah. So let's.
So yeah.
Yeah, I understand. Everybody. So he's saying, yeah. Yeah, there probably is. So, again, as someone who is working on themselves. Let's just say we're people who are working on themselves. Right? We're in a process of trying to become better human beings, to heal ourselves, to transform ourselves, to, you know, be more loving, be more open, more patient, more nonviolent, you know, all those kinds of things. I mean, there may be here people who are express it different ways, but let's say I would imagine most of the people here are here because there is some transformation that they are involved in, right? Okay. Now, again, if that is really our focus, right, then we are less quick to jump on the other, and probably first to take a look at ourselves. Right? Now, again, I'm not talking about, that, you know, analysis creates paralysis. It's not like we have to analyze everything we do. I mean, that's an extreme. Let's say you have a supervisor at work or a colleague at work, and your perception is they're kind of sarcastic with you, or they seem to put you down a lot, and right? And it's creating what kind of feelings inside you? Yeah, you get angry, or you get hurt, or you start having kind of revenge fantasies, and, right? So you notice there's all kinds of stuff going on inside you. You're not able just to let it pass. So I guess the first thing I would go with, well, you know, what's that about? Right? Right? Why is it so disturbing to me? I mean, when people, I keep forgetting your name. Your name is
David.
That's right. So, David, if you had a colleague who always said, "You are the nicest guy. I love working with you. You know, it's always building you up, telling you that you're the brightest, best thing that's come to this company, you know, ever." You know, would you have a problem with that? Right? Well, but even exaggerated. I mean, most of the time we'll take it, won't we? On that side, right? All right, but even if, but anyhow. But you understand? So when they're complimentary and they're positive and supportive, we don't seem to have a problem with it, do you? We're quite happy to have their judgments about us, right? But all of a sudden, when it's coming in not the way we want it to come in, right? We find that we get what? Agitated, right? It bothers us. We get angry. We begin to, you know, have little dialogues in our mind of what we'd like to say to them, or we begin to call them names in our mind, right? Now, why is that? Why is that causing this very different response for me than the other person who gives me compliments, right? There has to be something probably having to do with ego. And what do we know about ego? Poor, pitiful ego. It likes what? It likes things that build it up. It doesn't like things that build it down, right? That tear it down. It likes what? It wants everybody to love them. It wants everybody to think highly of them, doesn't it? And when it perceives somebody doesn't like them or somebody doesn't respect them the way they think they should be respected, ego gets very what? Bent out of shape. Right? So it's interesting. Right? To see deeply what is the cause really of my discomfort with this person. Right? Why can't it just roll off my back? Right? Because usually, you know, when someone talks to us that way, usually in our mind we'll create a story about, you know, they really are a jerk, right? Or they really are an idiot, or they're really, right? Now, if that's true, if they're such jerks and idiots, why do we care what they think about us? Right? I mean, it's interesting. I mean, because we will diminish them in our mind, and yet we'll really care about what they think about us or say to us. I mean, you'd think if we really thought they were such nincompoops, we wouldn't care what they said. Right? It would just be, yeah, he's an idiot. Why should I care what he thinks about? I mean, we don't really talk. But do you see what I'm saying? So when we're practicing this way, we're looking deeply. Why is this so disturbing to me? And in that sense, you know, in the Mahayana tradition of Buddhism, we say it's very bizarre. It sounds bizarre, but we say the person who gives us the hardest time is our spiritual friend. Now, why is that? Just for that. Because it's the people that give us the hard time, the people who don't like us, the people who say these kinds of things to us. They show us our Achilles heel. They show us our vanity. They show us our arrogance. They show us these things. People who are always kind and loving to us, they don't help us in this way, do they? Right? So if we're really serious about being free of our egocentricity, this guy at work is very helpful to you. So first you need to do your own deep looking and your own healing and transformation of that place that's created such drama around this for yourself. Now, having said that, and this is very important, when we act in the world, right, which is what you're talking about, am I acting from a self place or am I acting from a compassionate place? Right? In other words, once I'm okay within myself with this person, you know, but then I go, but this guy still has kind of significant social, you know, lack of social skills here. You know, or it's not good for him to go around, you know, because nobody likes him. Right? You know, and he might not even realize how he offends people, right? I mean, he may think he's helpful, or he may think he's funny, or he may think, you know, he's really spurring you on, or something. You know what I'm saying? So when we are okay within ourselves, we've done our work, but we still think this is a problematic situation, right? Then your good communication skills and everything can be very helpful, can't it? But you're doing it not just to, set him straight. You're doing it because you realize, you know, this guy's got a way of interacting with people, that causes people to dislike him, right? And he may be somebody who really deep down would like to be liked, but he kind of goes about it in this very kind of skewed way. You see, at that point, you can have a good conversation with him. And maybe shine a little light in his direction so he can kind of see what he's doing. Or at least know that his words are maybe not having the effect, you know, that he thought they had. But the first thing again in this practice is, you know, why is this getting to me? Right. You know, coming back to Hanshan, you know, most people come up here and think this is, you know, people love waterfalls, right? And most people love waterfalls. Right? They love the sound of the waterfall. Most people think it's calming. He's going, it's ruining my meditation because it's noise. Does that make sense? Yes, Alan. See what he's doing? See, this is why, you know, in Buddhism we say neither to be uplifted or downcast by what people say about you, right? So, I mean, if I could, you know, Alex can tell me he can do all his stuff, and I go, well, thank you, Alex. And then, you know, somebody over here, Nadja, can go, Fred, that was the stupidest, most muddled Dharma talk I've heard, only confused the matter, and I can go, well, thank you for telling me that. You know, if I can have equanimity, right? I mean, I can accept praise, and I can accept criticism, I can accept somebody who thinks I'm wonderful, I can accept somebody who thinks me terrible, then I have equanimity, right? If not, if my up and down is conditioned by, you know, by what people say about me, can you see? I'm doomed. I'm doomed emotionally, right? Because I've given everybody power over me. you know, it's a very dangerous, emotionally dangerous place to be. Especially if you want a peaceful mind. So we have to let people think we're, you know, the most wonderful Dharma teachers in the world, and some people think we're the most terrible Dharma teachers in the world. Right? So, yes.
I now feel obligated to give you the negative.
Okay, good.
I'd like to talk, or I'd like to hear your thoughts about self-training and influence when it comes to these teachings. And what I mean by that is the issue of unmindful consumption. We hear in the five mindfulness trainings that we should stay away from unwholesome TV programs, unwholesome magazines, whatever, radio, but that's real. It's not something that is just hypothetical or that it doesn't have an effect in terms of influencing us.
Yes.
On this transformational path, on this journey that we're taking, where we're trying to practice and become better at what we do and how we live, how do we then incorporate those realities into these teachings where we get to a certain point where we can say we've reached that equanimity, but we're not there yet? And the real problems are the influences around us.
Yeah. And again, I think that is a... Again, I think that is very personal and situational. The mindfulness trainings are guidelines. You know, there's a... I remember reading years ago in Ramakrishna, he used the example about spiritual practice in terms of spiritual development, and he would say, and if anybody's been to India, they would see this, because there are so many cows and goats and animals that are roam free, that if one is planting a tree, right? One puts a little fence around it. You know, you see that all over. And what Ramakrishna says, when the tree is green and small, right, it needs a fence around it so it doesn't get eaten, right? But once the tree is 10 feet, 15 feet high, you can take the fence away, right? Because now it has some bark that the goat or the cow won't eat it. And I think that, in terms of a developmental model, is something, you know, in the early stages of practice, when we are very affected by influences, right? We have to be careful, don't we? We have to probably put more fences around us, right? Because we know that we are... Our practice is not strong enough that we can be around these negative or toxic influences without the toxicity entering us. But as our practice deepens, right, and our capacity to see clearly develops, I think we have greater capacity to be around these things without, you know, we don't need such an all-encompassing fence around us. Is that clear? For example, let's take alcoholism, right? We know that somebody who is just very recently been an active alcoholic, is probably best for them to not be around anybody who drinks and not to be around any alcohol at all. Why? Because their sobriety is very fragile. They still can be influenced. But we know that somebody who has many years of sobriety and it's very strong in them, you know, can be around people who drink and they just don't drink, right? They can be around alcohol but are not tempted to drink. But it's a developmental model, you know, and you can't apply one, right? Yeah, so it's, if we become too pure, right, then... We don't want to become so pure that we cannot be in the world. You know, because as bodhisattvas, our goal is to be able to be in the world and to help people. But if we become so pure, that we can't, that we can't be around all these kinds of people, these kind of situations, because, it's all impure, then we can only be around people like ourselves, which can be all right. But if our desire is to really go into places of darkness to bring light, to go to places where people are suffering, then we have to develop ourselves to a point that we can go there and that we can bring them to us rather than them bringing us to them. And that's, see, we really, but again, that's very personal. You know, one has to be very honest with oneself. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it's a very good answer because we are all at different stages, so you can walk out of here after hearing this teaching and think, well, you know, I'm not doing it right, or I'm not there yet, and I shouldn't be feeling this or that. But to understand that it is developmental, I think it's encouraging.
Yeah, and I think it's important to understand it's developmental. I mean, if we take great leaps and bounds, you know, I'm going to be like this, and I'm going to, you know, and I'm going to just, we see that. A lot of people in spiritual paths get very distorted, right? They get very distorted, and they get very out of touch with themselves, and they just kind of take on a kind of pseudo-spiritual persona, which is not grounded in real reality. And then eventually it'll crumble or something will screw up, you know? So it's important that we, you know, have a real honesty about ourselves and where we're at and you know, what we need to do. So that was a good question, you know, I mean. You have a question? So this, and then we should stop. Yes, Susan.
Okay, the question is about looking deeply and exactly what that means. And I'm thinking about how I react to my sister and certain tones of voice, and I feel like I look deeply, you know, I understand what's triggering me, but still triggering me. So when you say looking deeply, you know, and I understand my reaction, you know, blah, blah, blah. But what does looking deeply mean?
All right. So you have a sister, and you have a history with your sister, and obviously there's something in the history with your sister that is not harmonious. And she has a certain tone of voice or something, and when you hear it, it immediately sets off an emotional, a visceral reaction in you. Okay. And you've looked into it, and you realize you understand the whole history, and blah, 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 and you get that. And yet still what?
Still there.
Yeah. So I would say a couple of things. The first thing I'd say is, that's okay. You understand why you react. You understand the causes. And you understand that something's still deep in you that you have not been able to heal yet. Okay? Knowing that can be helpful because it means when it arises, you understand why it's arising. But also, you don't have to let it keep going. Okay? You know, I don't want to give too much tonight. Probably how much Dharma can you throw at people in one night? You know, but there's a wonderful expression that says, you know, in a certain way, our practice of Dharma begins after something happens. You know, in other words, like the first thought that arises, the first emotional reaction, that's our conditioning, right? And most of the time, this stuff just arises without us any control or consciousness of it. It's all of a sudden, you know, the thought arises, the judgment arises, the impulse arises, you know, because it's just the way we've always done it. And that just happens. But what practice gives us is, then what? In the past, that first thing arises, and we just go with it, and we build on it. One chain after the other until it gets big. Right. What practice gives us, if we have insight, looking deeply in mindfulness, is we see that it has arisen, and we don't have to let it keep going. That's where we have the power to change things. We can't change the first one. It's deeply ingrained. It'll soften in time as we stop feeding it. But that takes time. That's a slow diminisher. Right? But you know your sister calls. She gets a certain tone of voice. You owe me to get that reaction. But you, oh, I see what's going on. I see. Yeah, I can understand it. And you just don't go with it. You don't feed it. And so it goes back down. But it goes back down into your unconscious, storehouse conscious is what's called in Buddhism. It's not as strong because you haven't fed it again. And it'll, you know, it may keep coming up, but it'll keep, if we don't feed it, it'll get weaker. So thank you everyone for coming. Yes. Okay. Right. Do our best. Thank you. So again, thank you all for coming tonight. Just one final bell.